March 10th, 2016. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we have guests, Lady Jo Carson of Fairferia and Lady Anne Finnan of the Roebuck, and we'll have a discussion on fairy magic. And we will recall the classics in this field, such as The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, Evans Wentz, 1919, The Fairy Queen by Edmund Spenser, 1590, and more recently, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell by Susanna Clarke, and that's 2004. Now, Lady Jo Carson will mention some other recent books in the field, including one she is working on now involving Fred Adams' extrapolations from Robert Graves' Celtic tree alphabet from The White Goddess, 1946. Now, this book should be a veritable Kabbalah of fairyland. And Lady Anne Finnan will mention the Roebuck's connection to Celtic fairy lore. And then I'll dive into the Book of Oberon, 2015, a translation of an Elizabethan 16th century magical compendium, mixing Solomonic and magic and fairy lore in a compendium similar to the Lamegaton, and it includes some Lamegaton material. So, let's all spend an hour under the hill with the changelings and the little people, and remembering what the old cunning man said, aye, you can see them if they want you to. And he also asked, what's your name? What's your quest? What's your favorite color? Remember that? Okay, who am I speaking with right now?
Who's right? Here's Jo Carson.
Oh, Lady Jo. Lady Jo, good to have you on. Is Anne? Is Anne also on?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes, she is.
Both my gracious ladies are in attendance. That's wonderful. What I'd like to do first is, as we said in the abstract, I'd like to mention some of the source material that we're on this, that we're all familiar with. And this, the fairy faith in Celtic countries that Evans once, he's the same anthropologist who put together the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, and the Oxford Tibetan series. Fairy faith in Celtic countries is really wonderful, and I know we all have it. And I remember at the SOMA conference we had 2 years ago, we had a fellow giving a talk on fairy magic, and I mentioned that after he got done with his talk. Oh, yeah, sure. He said we all cut our teeth on that one. And that's one that we all should have in our library on the fairy magic thing. And the Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell, and which we've all which I know that we here have read, and also an excellent film too that the British made on that. That's the novel Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norell by Susanna Clarke. And I want to mention something on that. I thought, as many people have when they read that book, that she got her Raven King, you know, the fairy magician who was in the other dimension, the Raven King. I thought she got that perhaps from some folklore base, but apparently she made that up herself. That's her own creation, and that's a marvelous creation too, by the way. And but also too, we mentioned that Joe, and we want you to talk about this book that you're doing on Fred Adams' extrapolations from Robert Graves' Celtic tree alphabet from The White Goddess. And of course we should remember that The White Goddess is another source book on fairy magic, obviously, and that's 1946. That's Robert Graves. So, Lady Jo, you want to tell us about some of the other books in this field that you know about that you might want to talk about a little bit and possibly recommend?
Yeah, there's a really interesting book that lately I've been involved with, a kind of a fairy faith reading group. We're reading a particular book together. It's an online group called Guinevere and the Round Table. It's by Wendy Berg. And the general thesis is that the Round Table was actually a secret initiatory system known to the fairy folk and taught to the knights by Guinevere, who was actually fairy herself. And the reason behind doing that was that fairy, and as a representative of fairy, Guinevere knew this, fairy and humans would all do better if they were in alignment with each other in harmony. And this was really integrated in this book with the story of Joseph of Arimathea and his journey from the Holy Land with the Grail. And it turned out that the knights who were with him, or the people who were with him, became divided into two groups, those who could see the Grail and benefit from it, and then those who couldn't, because it was on kind of a higher level of vibration. They couldn't quite see it. And that those people became the first knights and of the Grail. And in the book, Berg actually gives the reader training on how to actually see on a higher vibrational level. And the point is that fairy, it coexists with us here in this world, but that it's on a slightly faster or higher vibrational level. And by training ourselves, starting with the different colors of the rainbow, we can actually attune our own vision so that we can see something that we couldn't really see before, which is the world of fairy. And then she goes through this, these trainings, and gets towards the end to where you go to the higher level colors, like indigo, and then you're going out away from just the earthly realm, going up into the actual round table, which turns out to be a set of circumpolar constellations. And so you're looking up towards the North Star at these constellations to circle it, and each constellation has its own initiation. You go there in kind of a trance journey. So that's an interesting book, and I've come to have quite a bit of respect for it. I'd like to recommend that one. That's quite a bit of information, but I have about three other books that I'd love to talk about if you want to take the time for it.
Yeah, well, this is what we want to cover. We want to kind of cover the field for
okay.
Yeah. So what other ones do you recommend? And would you would,
I want to just recommend in general the works that, and there's over 25 works by Robert J. Stewart. He writes books and teaches workshop and fairy tradition. He wound up including a lot of trance work. He talks about going through the moon pool to go to these fairy realms, including these magical fairy cities. One person that I believe, well, a couple people that studied with him, or at least his works, included Orion Foxwood, who's become very popular. He's noted mostly as a root worker, but and that kind of like southern shamanic tradition, but he also is someone who writes about the fairy seership tradition. And then Kisma Stepanich is a gal who's written a couple of books. I think she wrote, let's see, Fairy Wicca, and then which is subtitled Syrian Magic, A Book of Shadows and Light, which includes a lot of things that you might find in sort of a Wicca book, except with a very fairy twist. And it's not artificial. It seems really genuine. And I think her work is good, too. She also created a fairy Wicca, which is a series of tarot cards with beautiful, beautiful illustrations, I must say. And she relates these different groups of cards that she has, which don't always follow the traditional tarot attributions, to various aspects of fairy, especially these cities, these fairy cities, which are traditionally kind of on an etheric level but related to Ireland, called Murius, Valius, Gorius, and Findius.
She doesn't mention the sunken city of Ys in Brittany, does she?
You know, I don't remember her mentioning that. It's been quite a while since I've read the book, so she might include something else beyond what I recall. You know, there was another city in addition to those four that was in the center, too, and I don't recall the name of it just now. Right. Now, I want to also mention, just because it's fascinating to know these things, there's one other... and I'm not necessarily recommending this particular book, but it's just kind of interesting. There's a new book, relatively new book out, called Witchcraft in America, I think it's called. And this one is kind of an overview type book, A Witches in America by Alex Marr. And she, among other things, went into the world of fairy, spelled F-E-R-I. And that world is a world of fairy faith that was pretty much brought to the world's attention, or maybe brought to the world completely, not completely known, by Victor Anderson. His followers are very famous, including Starhawk and Francesca de Grandis, who was in my film Dancing with Gaia, a wonderful speaker. Gwydion, this whole tradition had a lot of influence on the Church of All Worlds. And within her book, which is in America, she does describe something which I'm pretty sure is supposed to be like one of their, you know, secrets, but it's in a book now, so I'm going to mention it. Apparently, the secret names of the divinities are imparted as part of this initiation that they receive. The reasons that the binding things that sort of seem to bind that tradition together is that they believe in personal transformation and sort of a fluid version of sexuality. They sort of have a kind of an ecstatic approach, shall we say, to spirituality. So that's an interesting book that, you know, goes into those aspects of fairy. I think there's also a lot of information available online, but these are, you know, kind of some notable books that I've run into in my searching journey.
Yeah, you know, I think what I mentioned is we talk about the sex between fairies and regular human people, and this had an influence. This influenced the Hermetic tradition in the realization of the elementals in European Hermeticism. And in Rosicrucianism, and frankly, you know, it's obvious when you read the Comte de Gabalée and you read the stories about the hidden land of Magonia, and you just know that the Celtic fairy tradition is behind this, even though it's supposedly Hermetic and the elementals, you know, the sylphs and the. And the sylphs are very fairy-like, and the gnomes and the salamanders and the we got the salamanders and the fire, we have the gnomes and the earth, and we have the sylphs and the air, and the undines, of course, are the mermaids in the water, and all of these kind of derive from fairy traditions, and they enter into hermetic tradition in that respect. Lady Anne, what would you like to add to this in the way of books that you would recommend, or especially those that might be connected to the Roebuck tradition?
Well, just listening to the conversation about the sexuality, sacred sexuality between humans and the fairy folk. We were talking last week, I believe, about the movie Secret of Rowan Inish, which was a British film, and it didn't have a big distribution here, but basically it was the idea that in many Celtic countries, and not just Celtic countries, and Norse countries, and pagan faiths of all sorts, the idea that the shamans and the magicians and the medicine folk and the cunning folk and the people with the sight who were able to see visions and things were these people were the result of fairy-human matings, and that there were children that were born to these matings, mm-hmm. and there was a bloodline that came down through the generations of people who had magical powers and who were able to see things that ordinary mortals couldn't see, and who had special relations with the nature spirits and the unseen ones and that sort of thing. And you had a lot of Celtic stories, which were, of course, edited heavily by the church, but you can see it where the druids and the kings and the heroes of Celtic Ireland and Scotland were in some way of this bloodline, that originally they were human mortals who mated with the unseen ones, the elders, the elder gods, the fairies, the whatever they were called in that particular culture, and their children had special powers. You saw this in the Book of Enoch, where the Tubal-Cain and Jubal-Cain and Niama and that bloodline of magicians and workers in metal and musicians and Niama was their sister, and she was the one who taught humans divination and that kind of thing. These
were
all
interesting. It's interesting that
it was
that
same
this
kind of
thing
where you had a human god, angel, fairy, you know, call it what you will, a non-human, a supernatural being mating, and that it spawned a bloodline of people that had special powers. So this isn't just Celtic. This is all over the world.
Well, you know, on this bloodline thing, I want to mention that Shakespeare had in the Midsummer Night's Dream, he has Oberon and Titania, the king and the queen of the fairies, and they're having a squabble, and that's upsetting nature and everything else. And interestingly enough, Shakespeare sets the Midsummer Night's Dream in Greece, and the reason for that is that there is, at least as far as his research indicated, there was a Greek connection to Oberon, that Greek connection, unfortunately, that Greek connection apparently, when it gets to Europe, it gets into the Merovingian line. With Oberon. So, unfortunately, we're back into the same situation, that we had with the Holy Grail, you know, with trying to figure out whether it's Joseph of Arimathea or whether it's Mary Magdalene in France or Joseph of Arimathea in Gloucester or in Glastonbury. You know, if we were to conjure Oberon, as they try to do here in the Book of Oberon, and he shows up as a 3-year-old kid, according to the Book of Oberon, and of course, so we get this little 3-year-old kid, so we bring him up and a little kid, and we said, well, Oberon, are you the king of the British fairies? And he says, no, no, I am the king of the French fairies, you stupid English person, you. You know, get off my toadstool, go away. So we're right back to the same situation, you know.
if you took Oberon and you changed his name a bit, he might end up being kind of a Dionysus figure, you know, a Rex Nemerensis, a king of the woods, where he was a nature god who was someone who was the kind of a guardian of the woods and spirits. He was a consort of the Diana. He was the sacred king that becomes her consort and her son. I mean, the whole idea of Diana being, you know, the virgin huntress, but she had a consort that was the sacred king, the Rex Nemerensis, the stag-headed one.
So much of this goes back to Greek mythology. You know, so much of it goes back to classical mythology, which in turn permeates on into Druidic mythology and into European mythology, and even into the Nordic. And along that line, I'd like to get back to Lady Jo with the book on the tree alphabet. We can't avoid in this discussion of the fairy tradition and the fairy magic tradition. Of course, the white goddess is absolutely, you know, that's like the fairy faith in Celtic countries. It's one of these books that you just have to, you know, you have to deal with. And according to what Lady Jo has told me, that actually Robert Graves gave Fred Adams permission to go ahead and expand on his tree alphabet. And of course, which is in the White Goddess, and I've seen a lot of Fred's extrapolations from that, and they're fascinating, and Joe's working on it. You want to tell us about that, Lady Jo?
Sure. Let me just give you a little background. I guess I'm going to start with mentioning the name of my book just because I'm going to forget it otherwise. Yet to be published, okay, but it's more than just a book, actually. It's an oracle system. The name of it is called The Green Pulse Oracle, a tool for eco-psychic insight. And so it is an oracle system in the sense that there's a book, and then there's little markers that actually have each of the glyphs on them. Fred called them Xerian hieroglyphs. That's kind of a mouthful, and so we decided to make it a little simpler and not include that in the title. But what they are is the beautiful symbols that Fred created. And each one goes with one of those tree alphabet names. So there's one for Beth, one for Luis, one for Neon, et cetera. And they're also correlated with the tarot, the major arcana of the tarot, and with the seasons and with the trees and, you know, the zodiac. I mean, there's a million or at least many correlations. And the way to really grok all at once the correlations is to imagine that you're looking at a circular calendar with spring in the east and summer in the south, like you would look at a hinge if you were looking at it from above, and that the tree alphabet calendar goes around that circle just exactly in the same order as the seasons change and as you have the attributions of everything that goes with east, such as dawn and initiations and beginnings. That also goes with that first letter of I just said that and I'm wrong. I'm sorry, it begins, for this particular calendar, it begins at midwinter and then it goes around the circle from there, right? So Beth is actually at the beginning at the north there and then it goes around the circle from there. But I want to just clarify something because the tree alphabet goes way back further than Robert Graves, and what Robert Graves did was make clear the calendrical aspect of it. And that's what he gave Fred permission, specific permission to use. If you go all the way back to the Oum, and some people call it Oakum, that's a method of writing that was in use like from 200 to 600 AD in the Celtic countries, mostly in Ireland, somewhat Scotland and England. And they were writing on trees, so it may have gone back even further, and of course the trees would be gone or the pieces of wood. But they also wrote on stones, and there's almost 300, I think, different of these inscriptions still left. And each of their letters had the similar name, you know, the Beth, the Luis, the Neon, you know, Strafe, all these different specific names, which had, many of them were corresponding to the first name or the first letter of a tree that would go with it. So the tree alphabet goes back, you know, really a long way. And it was written up by this fellow. It was in the Book of Ballymote, which was like in 1300, and then this other person, and then there was the Ogygia. So this is Robert Flaherty. He was a historian. So these are things that go back to, you know, even like 1500s and like, you know, a long time ago from now, way before Robert Graves. But when Robert Graves got a hold of it, he wanted to put together this beautiful system, which he did, and he made it very clear that he thought it would correspond with being on a calendar. And there was dispute about that. Some call it, scholars are like, oh, you know, he took it too far. You know, there's no proof that ancient people did that. But I'm going to just hold out that I think that really they probably did, because when you have trees, the very first one that's going to leaf out each year is, in fact, the birch tree. And so there's like, you can find the different trees that are on the calendar. they'll have maybe flowers or berries at the time. In other words, they have some epiphany at the time of the year that they're assigned to, and it would be a very easy way to memorize the alphabet by also relating to what's going on in the seasons, just the way that our little kids memorize the ABCs. And if they had something to relate them to, it would probably make it a little easier. I suspect that it was really used both ways, you know, that it was both an alphabet, way of memorizing an alphabet was thinking about what order the seasons are in, and then, you know, at the same time it became a calendrical system.
I've also seen it used as like a zodiac, where you have the wheel of the year that begins at the spring equinox, and you've got you can use it as almost a zodiacal system, very similar to the Ptolemaic world view, the whole idea of it being an analogy to the stars. The Druids, along with most ancient peoples, were very sophisticated as far as their astronomy was concerned. And this goes back to what you were saying earlier about the cosmos and the whole idea of this not just being a wheel of the year, it's the wheel of the stars. And you've got a kind of a Hamlet's Mill idea where you have the world tree that goes up and is a center point around which the cosmos itself whirls. And so you've got as above, so below. You've got the stars that are reflected in the seasons of the year, and these things are marked by symbols. And the Om is one that just kind of falls into place, you know, and you try to fit it to other systems. It just kind of all fits together like little pieces of a puzzle. It's very, very wonderful.
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity there, and certainly one can get quite deeply involved in it. I think there's another thing I wanted to mention, if there's kind of some space here for me to do it. I'm only offering here. I think that when we talk about fairy, it's really important to remember that fairy has slightly different qualities than like what we emphasize is important here in our day-to-day lives on the world. And that the fairies are often, you know, depicted like playing, you know, wonderful music and reciting poetry and dancing out in the woods and that kind of thing. And that, there's always like the fairy ring that people talk about. And I think that that since we understand fairy as always doing well when wild nature does well, that if we're going to talk about fairy faith, that anybody that's involved in fairy faith almost by default is either inviting the fairies into their circle or having some kind of direct relationship with the fairies. It's not, you know, just sexual, or it's not just intellectual, or, you know, some kind of trance work. It's like have a direct relationship with the earth as being, you know, this sort of sacred living thing. It's our environment and it's everything that's around us, and you're kind of invested in that. I mean, that's, I think, very central to the idea of any of these fairy faith approaches. I kind of wanted to offer, I have this tiny poem, which I just discovered in Fred's, you know, voluminous writings, which was written published in 1926 by the Aldine House, which is a fairy society, a precursor, Fred says, of Fairfairia. So if I may, I'd like to read that. It's very short. Would that be all right?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So it's by Bernard Slay, and I'll just begin. Still do they wander here, disconsolate upon this earth we spoil, with wistful eyes that peer upon the ugliness of mortal toil. Each dewdrop holds a tear from small and faithful eyes that stare aghast to see their fairy year of lovely artistry on dunghill cast. Still, they do hover near where madcap human monkeys mop and mow, and in green valleys rear their vulgar, trivial villas all a row. Only the faithful see their temple spires and steeples still agleam, or hear the fairy voice across the sea. Their voice is calling from the hills of dreams.
Yeah, that's very good. You know, one of the things that we should emphasize here is the parallel worlds concept of fairyland, and you know, this is usually it kind of the idea of you go out in the moonlight and you find them out there dancing around the toadstools and that little thing. They used to call a ring of mushrooms a fairy ring, you know, and they would in the moonlight somehow the veil between the dimensions would open and they could dance, you know. And then there was this under the hill idea, and this may have had something to do with those burial mounds that, you know, where they used to bury the old Celtic kings and whatever. That might have had some influence on the folklore tradition of the under the hill, you know, that the fairies, and that also could have some relationship between fairies and ghosts. But the other dimension, in other words, the whole idea of these creatures, humanoid, if you will, or a combination of nature and human form, animal and plant and human form, that would exist in another dimension and connected to plant life and geological features and everything, very, very much in the realm of, as I say, the hermetic elementals, and therefore through that analog connected to hermetic magic. And one of the things that I wanted to mention, you know, in our discussion tonight, is this book that recently published called The Book of Oberon, and originally published by Llewellyn. And what this is a fascinating Elizabethan grimoire. And it's very much like the Lamegaton. It's a compendium. You know, the Lamegaton, as we all know, was a wizard's handbook, and whoever originally put it together put all the books that he wanted to use under one, you know, in one cover, and he ended up with the Goetia and the Theurgia Goetia and the Almadel and the Art Pauline and the Ars Notoria, and he bound them all together because they were the books that he wanted to use. And it came down to us as the Lamegaton. Well, this Book of Oberon is Elizabethan, and it in manuscript form, it came into the hands of, I believe, the heiress of the Folger, the Folger coffee heiress, and so it's technically referred to as the Folger manuscript, but they've called it the Book of Oberon because Oberon the fairy, the king of the fairies, is one of the main spirits that they want to evoke here. But this book is this collection of magic that is specifically Elizabethan. It's from that period, from Shakespeare's period, and I find this absolutely fascinating because that's the same period basically where the Lamegaton comes from, and there's a lot of Lamegaton magic in this book, and in fact they even have a more authentic version of the Elemental Kings than actually got into the original Lamegaton. So. There's a number of things in this book that are really fascinating. For one thing, they have which are not particularly interest to us, they have what amounts to about a four-page-long consecration of a magic mirror. And then they have magic mirrors, more magic mirror information, including magic mirror and triangle in two instances, and So in a way, this very much backs up our particular version of Solomonic Evocation. And the book is translated by Daniel Harms and illustrated by James R. Clark and also Joe Peterson. He got into it too and did some research and helped with it. It's called The Book of Oberon, and it's really fascinating. And one of the things they have in here, besides a conjuration for Oberon or Oberion, is that they have a spiritus locus called a fairy throne. Now this is really a fairy throne, and the way they do this is they have wands. They have these hazel wands, which have the names of the fairies, the various fairy spirits and kings, queens, and all, written down, inscribed on the wands, and then they set the wands up, pointing to the quarters. So you have two wands pointing to the south and two wands pointing to the north and two wands pointing to the east, two wands pointing to the west. And in the center, that's the fairy throne, and that's where you put this very interesting looking talisman. And you'll find this on page 361 in the book. I'll read a little bit of this here, but first, thou dost put this into the fairy throne. Provide four hazel rods of 1 year's growth. Cut them in the day and hour of Mercury, the moon increasing. Shave them white, then write upon every one of them the seven names in the hour of Mercury. And then they gives the names. And put these four wands in the four quarters, east, west, north, and south, the fairy throne in the hour of Mercury, and put the vessel in the midst of the fairy throne, repeating the seven names. As I say, the book is it's got a lot of stuff copied directly out of Agrippa and out of the Lamegaton and whatever. But and then a lot of original material too that I haven't seen before. It's really a fascinating book, I think it's one of the ceremonial magicians that especially if you're interested in this analog with the fairies, I think you're really going to enjoy it. Also too, while we're on the subject, I'd like to mention another book that deals to some degree with this. And this is a book that Christy Warsh gave me for Yule 1 year. It's called The Book of English Magic by Philip Carr, Philip Carr Gome, and Richard Haygate. And this is everything, including everything in English magic, including including Enochian and to some degree, fairy lore too, and regarding that, I don't think we need to read any of it, but I think that this is a book that covers, that puts the whole business in perspective. It puts English magic in perspective. It puts all these things, and it's a beautiful book. It's beautifully illustrated. Also, too, we mentioned Edmund Spenser's The Fairy Queen. Edmund Spenser was an Elizabethan-era poet, and what he wanted to do was to do a national, and celebrate Elizabeth's ascension to the throne, to celebrate her reign. He wanted to do a British epic poem, and he wanted it to be kind of like the Aeneid for like Virgil's Aeneid for the Romans, The Iliad and the Odyssey. You know, he wanted to have a mythological poem, and he wanted to create this mythological poem. So he wrote the Faerie Queen. And the Faerie Queen was very popular, and it first was published in 1590. And it's a romance, and it's you know, it has the knights. Gloriana is the queen of fairyland, and she is an analog for Elizabeth. You know, this is a metaphor for Elizabeth, and her knights go out and have these adventures, very much like Arthur's knights. And they meet, yeah. They kill dragons, and they slay dragons and ogres, and they do all the things that knights are supposed to do, and rescue ladies in distress, and battle with sorcerers and whatever. And it's fascinating, and of course it has influenced a lot of writers, especially fantasy writers. It's influenced writers like James Branch Cabell and Lord Dunsany, Clark Ashton Smith, and people like that. It also deals with the fairyland and the whole fairy tradition, so we ought to certainly realize that the Faerie Queen is very, very much a part of this tradition. I'd like to ask Anne. You remember some time back we discussed the Seine du Zac Menhir.
Yes. Yes. The stone, yeah, that has all the carvings on it.
That's right. Do you think that has some relation to this whole tradition?
It's hard to tell because we have no idea how old it is, and we have no idea if the symbols mean what we think they mean. You know, it's very, very easy to project what you want to see on old symbols, but I think that this particular tradition of fairy magic or the magic that comes from fairies is probably something that was widespread up until the end the death of Elizabeth, when all the religious wars happened, and you had Cromwell and his buddies scouring the countryside and breaking up the stone circles because they were pagan and all this stuff. If it was a marking stone that marked, say, the meeting place of a particular group, or had been, you know, attached to a dwelling place of some sort. It's very hard to know just what that stone was for. I suspect that as these stones happen, that it might have been the marking of a meeting place, or maybe marked a place of a house or a temple or something that is now not there anymore. So that could be. I have a feeling that a lot of this was far more widespread than we know, because so much of it had been destroyed, you know, during the Cromwellian era and all of the turmoil that went on during the English Civil War, and so much of British folklore was destroyed or driven underground, you know, during that period of time. So we don't know. But if it was a meeting place, you know, the marking a meeting place of a group, or it was the burial place of someone or whatever. Yeah, it could very well be. It would just have to depend on how old it was and how old the carvings were.
Yeah, and some of it's been apparently added to it. I think there have been things added to it. But I mentioned earlier on, I mentioned the City of Yeast, and that's YS. And this is an interesting legend. It's off the coast of Brittany, and it's an interesting legend which has been used by Poole Anderson and his wife did a couple of novels based on historical or mytho historical novels based on the Kingdom of Yeast, and Abraham Merritt did one of his fantasy stories based on this. And what it was, according to the legend, was a city down right on the coast of Brittany, where Brittany sticks out into the English Channel. And this city, very ancient, was actually below sea level. And apparently, they had built this this huge dike up around to protect the city, and they had some kind of a big sluice gate, and I think that this is one of these tidal situations where they had this big sluice gate, and according to the legend, it's kind of almost a Scheherazade type or Bluebeard type legend where the evil queen has. Tries to get the key from the king, from her father, the king, the key that he has the key to the gates that let in the tide and would flood the city, and her wife takes on these local lovers. Which she apparently sort of a reverse on Scheherazade, which as soon as she tires of them, she kills them. And one of them apparently tries to, before he gets killed, he tries to get her to, get the key from her father. And then he floods the whole city and kills her and everybody else. And that's the end of the evil city of Yeast and its evil queen. That's one version of the legend. There are several different versions of this thing, but one wonders what the relationship to Atlantis might be. And then also too, there's another version of this that seems to be off the coast of England, at Avalon. There's off the coast of England. What's the city that's supposed to be sunken off? Lyonesse, that's right.
Lyonesse.
Yeah.
It's off of I'm just trying to remember it's a point. We were there actually at one point. There was a it's an island, and there was a castle on the island, and you can only get to the castle at low tide, because then there's dry land between the coast and this island. But it, at high tide, it's an island. It's the road.
Sounds like Michelle.
It's very much like that. And apparently there was a castle or a monastery or something on this island. And there's a road with stones on it that actually leads to this thing. And you can only access it when the tide is at its absolute lowest. If you're on the road and the tide comes in, you get washed away. According to Arthurian legend, that was the castle of the dwarf king who was the father of Guinevere. And Arthur had to storm his castle in order to get Guinevere as his queen, and Merlin knew that at low tide there was a road that appeared, a stone path that would go from the beach to this castle, and he had Arthur and his men wait until the tide was at its lowest, and they were able to travel on this road to storm the castle and get Guinevere as his queen. So it so that goes back to Joe's idea about Guinevere being a fairy maiden who was the daughter of the dwarf king of this magical island. And and you had to have astronomical knowledge of the tides and the moon cycles in order to predict when the tide was going to be low enough so that a body of armed men could travel on this road in order to get to the castle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when Moorman did Excalibur, that was a beautiful film. He did another version of that where Merlin creates a sort of the breath of the dragon and Uther rides across and manages to impersonate Igraine's husband and who has just been killed in battle, and he impregnates her and gives birth to Arthur. That was Moorman's version of it. I don't know where he probably had some mythological basis for that.
Well, Tintagel Castle is kind of like that too. It's out on a cliff. On a point on a cliff, and what you would have to do is you'd have to find the road that leads from the shore to the castle. It's I've been there. It's on a very rocky crag, and you have to kind of find your way through the mist. You have to know where the road is. That leads up to that castle, and so it would be something that it would take a magician to know, because you'd probably have to find just the right. It's like that scene in Indiana Jones where the light just has to be exactly right so you can see the pathway that leads to the Grail Castle. So it would probably be that sort of thing where you'd have to wait until the sunlight was just right in order to see where the road was to go up to the castle. So that same sort of thing.
And if you don't, and if you give the wrong answer, you end up being thrown into the gorge.
If you don't find the right path, then you end up down at the bottom of the cliff. You know.
Yeah. And, what's your favorite color? Blue. No, it isn't. I just watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail the other night.
What was our
full of you.
Blue?
I was thinking, you know, that with Oberon and being Merovingian instead of English, that he would also, you know, say that no, I am the king of the French fairies. But anyway, we're about to the end of the hour here. Lady Joe, you're working on this book on the tree alphabet. When do you think you're going to have that ready for us?
The goal is this summer. I can't give you anything real precise right now because we're still adding things to it. I do have a first draft, but it's still a little bit fluid. So I'm definitely, you know, I'm trying to go for this summer, you know, midsummer. And I've got a really talented consultant working with me on it. Maka Nightmare, she's really, really helpful. So I'm optimistic. I think it's going to be beautiful. I have a lot of Fred Adams' really excellent artwork in there, not the same stuff that we've seen in the Celebrate Wildness.
Well, you do have your Celebration of Wilderness book available somewhere, don't you, for us?
Right, yeah, fairfaria.org. It's always available there, and if people are interested in Fairfaria, they can get that. And, you know, describe for people who may not be familiar with it. I just ran across a page of kind of cool descriptions by Fred of Fairfaria, so I'm going to read one. Fairfaria is the path of mystery through fairyland, a pagan fellowship for the erotic celebration of all nature and for the lyrical unification of ecology, mythology, and sacrament. Fairfaria. Let's see, we have 4 minutes before nine. I'm going to take 2 minutes, if I may, and just say one little thing about Fairfaria, about some of the things that we do specifically that are relating to fairy. We will often actually go out into the fairy ring henge and call up the fairy and invite them into our circle when we're doing our rituals. We will go out to wilderness locations that are on specific rays from our henge, like different specific directions, and then go into like a reverie and, you know, look visually to see if we can, you know, actually see the fairy folk or communicate with them and feel their presence. And then in those same wilderness locations, we might use trance to visit them and call on them for guidance or inspiration. And we offer little, you know, like some way to honor them. You know, we can always give them something when we do that. You know, there has to be an exchange. And then when we come back, there's a way you can set up an ongoing relationship with fairy by when you come back to your own home circle, you've taken something to your fairy, you know, friends you visited, and then you bring some little thing back. And so when you have relationships with the fairy folk in all of those directions that you visited, then you have your own little fairy henge is like the center of this great network that goes off in all directions around you. And so it's a lovely way to have a relationship with wild nature and with the fairy folk.
And the website again, where we go?
Oh, right, fairfaria.org. I'll spell it fairfaria.org. And Celebrate Wildness is available now, and hopefully this summer we'll have this lovely new book that I'm working on, which is The Greek Folk Oracle.
Okay, good. We did your Dear Departed novel last week, but let's mention that again. You just published a novel on spiritualism in the Victorian era up in San Francisco, kind of a romance and a thriller, and that's available under Anne Roebuck.
Yes, my nom de plume for romance novels, and I'll be able to, if the publisher is willing, I can get some other popular novels out there with hermetic and magical and pagan themes that sort of stealthily introduce some of these concepts to a wider audience.
That sounds like something we ought to all look forward to. And so do you want to give us a website that we can come to for some more activities that you might want to share with us?
Okay, it's annroebuck.com. It's annroebuck.com. It's still under construction, but there's a link for the book and a bio of me, and working on a blog with magical themes that that would be suitable for a larger audience, and I'm sort of trying that as an experiment to see if we can get more people interested in this sort of thing. I know a lot of the books that are out there are very daunting. You know, you have to do a lot of reading of mythology and folklore and history and all of that. And
right.
If we can get people introduced to it through fiction, which was what, of course, Dionne Fortune tried to do and succeeded in her time. But there's so much that was there that she couldn't write about because of being, you know, her time and place, that maybe we can take some of those themes and update them for a modern audience. And we'll see if this flies. It's always an adventure.
That's a worthy goal, and we will look forward to your efforts and naturally support them. And thank you both, gracious ladies. And next week, if I don't manage to find a distinguished guest to come on board, which I will try to do, but if that doesn't work out, then we'll return to H.P. Lovecraft and look at the case of Charles Dexter Ward, which is his most prominent effort, and that ought to be interesting. So until next week. Thanks again, Joe and Ann, and until next week, good magic.